Welcome to a Monday episode of the Soccer Central Podcast. I'm John Molinaro, Chief Soccer Reporter for Sportsnet.ca, back hosting another edition of the show. Last time out, we spoke to Winnipeg Bay Soccer reporter Jared Peters in looking ahead to the first leg of the European World Cup playoff games. And today we're going to chat with another Winnipeg-based writer about tomorrow's second leg matchups. Bobby McMahon is a well-known and respected commentator who appears regularly on Soccer Central TV show on Sportsnet and is regarded as one of the leading pundits in Canadian soccer circles. Bobby also writes for a number of publications, including a weekly column for Forbes, which really is a must-read as he tackles the latest issues in the soccer world with a great deal of eloquence and insight. Bobby has kindly taken time out of his schedule to talk to Soccer Central Podcast and joins us now on the phone from Winnipeg. Mr. McMahon, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, John, and somewhat humbled by that introduction.
Well, you know, gotta play up, right? Gotta build it up. So
I was waiting to see who you're talking about.
Oh, so modest. I guess the place to start would be Sweden and Portugal. The first leg on Friday in Lisbon very much billed as a one-on-one battle between Ronaldo and Ibrahimovic. But aside from Ronaldo's winner, they both had pretty quiet nights. I was quite impressed with Yao Pereira and Fabio Contrao. Just wondering who caught your eye.
I think overall the thing that impressed me, maybe not so much from an individual point of view in Portugal, but they really, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, Portugal are always on the cusp of falling apart, but I thought there was an enthusiasm and a commitment from the Portuguese game and a belief that they were going to get the goal that was really quite impressive. I think when you're in that kind of situation where you're in the playoffs, you're at home, first leg, there's a lot of pressure to get that goal, but you also don't want to concede that goal with the away goals potentially counting for this as well. And I thought Portugal remained committed and had that level of belief that the Swedes didn't have, that they were going to get that goal. And I think when you see the likes of Miguel Veloso, who's really pretty much a defensive midfield player, popping up on the left wing to provide the cross for Ronaldo to get the goal, I think that kind of sums up how committed they were to going forward and getting that win. So that's the thing that stood out for me, John.
Mm. And, you know, you mentioned Veloso, and everyone obviously talks about the goal that Ronaldo scored to sort of stoop down and head it with a defender draped all over him. But, you know, lost in all that was the ball that Veloso played to him. I thought it was quite pinpoint accurate.
Absolutely great cross, and with the kind of the swerve and the dip on it,
yeah,
it made it, I guess, and nothing's ever impossible, but it made it very difficult. It certainly put Isaacson in a situation where he had to make a split-second decision about what he was going to do, and he decided he wasn't going to come for it, which was probably the right decision, and he was waiting for his defender to deal with it. But, you know, overall, I have to say, Sweden's tactics were about as predictable as a set of IKEA instructions.
Well, speaking of Sweden, I mean, tactically, how do they approach this now? Because obviously, if they move players forward early, like they did last week in Lisbon, then it leaves them a little bit exposed at the back. So how do you see them playing out this one?
It's a difficult one for them because they haven't got a great deal of pace in that team. So they've got to be concerned about Portuguese pace on the counter-attack, because you do look at that Portuguese lineup and there is pace in there and there is a commitment or is a great potential to damage Sweden on the counter-attack. I think really Sweden have to approach it as, you know, sometimes we talk about this as being half-time in the game, and maybe that's the best way for Sweden to approach it. And when you're 1-0 down, the most important thing is not to get the equaliser. The most important thing is not to go 2-0 down, because at 1-0 you're only potentially, you know, 1 move or 5 seconds away from getting that equaliser, and I think you've got to make sure you're still in the game. So I don't think you're going to see an overly committed or an overly adventurous Swedish team, for no other reason. I don't think they've got it in them. Anyway, I don't think there's a level of that adventure there. And really, they're really desperately hoping that Ibrahimovic can come up with a bit of magic, or maybe a Charlstrom free kick or a Larsson free kick. They've got a number of guys that can be very effective in terms of dead ball delivery. So that might be an option for them as well. But honestly, and you know, I know some Swedish people, and they're really lovely lovely nation and very nice people, but God, I hope they don't make the World Cup finals. They're deathly boring. They're just absolutely, you know, eke out the group, get to the last 16, go
right.
home. That's
yeah.
it, year after year. It's a long time, 20 years since we saw an interesting Swedish team.
I would agree.
Back to the I guess, 94 with, you know, really, that's probably the kind of first look we really got at Henrik Larsson.
Yeah.
But that Swedish team was a decent team, but we haven't seen many since.
Yeah. Did that side have Thomas Brolin as well?
Yes, it did.
Yeah. That was a very adventurous side.
Yeah, and I think that was the tournament that got him a move to Leeds. And as soon as he arrived in Leeds, he seemed to pack on about 40 pounds and was useless.
Right. Some of the other games, France returns home with a two-goal deficit to overturn. They created very little in the final third in Ukraine last week. How surprised were you, if at all, were you there about their rather tame attacking performance in Kiev?
I was, John, except when I stood back, and this is my column for Forbes this week, on should we really be surprised that France are struggling? Because the bottom line to this is France have struggled for a long time. The last real impact they made was 2006, getting to the final against Italy. But you look at it after that, 2008, they had 1 point out of three games in the group stage at the Euros. 2010, the World Cup in South Africa, there was the meltdown, but there again, they finished bottom of that group. They only had the one draw. And then they went to Ukraine, Poland in summer of 2012. At least they finished with a 1-1-1 record, but then they went out very limply to Spain. So you look at the last three performance at major competition, and the reality is France have been a non-entity. They haven't been a factor, and I think we continue to think about them in terms of the Zidane generation and the Thierry Henry generation, and the fact is that's gone, and it's a new team, and they've got some very good players, but they're missing some very vital components, and they've got some real obvious weaknesses, and one of them is the ability to deal with any level of pressure. And when they're in that situation, they tend to lose the plot, I think.
I wonder, too, if this is a matter of they're a talented side individually, but collectively they don't seem to play as a team, and that they really have to find a way to be better than the sum of their parts.
Absolutely. I think that sums it up. You know, great teams are always greater than the sum of their parts, but France managed to be lesser than the sum of their parts. And I think in particular, you look at some of the creative players. Ribéry was kind of boxed out of it. I thought Ukraine did a really good job on Ribéry. Fedetsky, the right back, would be good in front of him, but Selsenyov, who played very tight to Fedetsky, between the two of them, every time Ribéry got the ball, he was facing two of them, and he finished up having to play a pretty negative, conservative ball to Nasri. And then you got Nasri, who hasn't got... He's a great continuity player, and he's a good wide player, but you put him in the centre of the midfield and expecting him to get up beside Giroud and help him, he just hasn't got it in him. And so you had these kind of conservative passes going right across the front of the goal. Very rarely did France manage to get behind the Ukraine fullbacks. And I think, you know, basically, every time Nasri got the ball, it really played into the Ukraine's hands.
Hmm. Also, I mean, Koscielny obviously earned that late red card. And,
yep.
and so that's one of the changes that Didier Deschamps is going to have to make. It's enforced. But do you see him making wholesale changes? I mean, is he going to stick with the two defensive midfielders? Does he give Sagna a start? How much change do you see there?
It's interesting you brought up the two defensive midfield players. You'd think by playing two defensive midfield players, what you're really trying to do is establish a real strong framework in the centre of the park. But the bottom line was, I thought Matuda and Pogba, although Pogba was on the ball a lot, they looked really susceptible on the counter-attack. Ukraine has got a little bit of pace in that some of the players up front. Yarmolenko, I think, is a very good player. So they have got that pace, and I think they looked worried. And then when they got past these two, you know, Koscielny, when he melts down, really melts down, and he had one of these games on Friday. So I think you've got to be a little bit more creative. I think Valbuena is going to come in. I think I would certainly play him because I think he's a lot more dynamic than Nasri, and I think he's got the ability to make things happen. He just has that sharpness about him. Nasri tends to, I think, And we saw in these Arsenal days as well, when you get into these situations where back fours are sitting deep, Nasri has this kind of almost kind of rhythm he gets into, which is just constant. And he just keeps on trying to do the same things, and it never really manages to break down that defence. So I think you'd see that. You know, France have, there's a monumental task in front of them, and of course they can't afford to lose a goal either. Otherwise, they'd have to be scoring four to go through. So they're in a great predicament in terms of how they approach the game and who they approach the game with. I think the pressure on Deschamps is going to mean he's going to have to make changes, because I don't think he's probably willing to go down with the same crew that let him down in Kiev.
Hmm. We're speaking with Bobby McMahon, noted Canadian soccer pundit, about Tuesday's World Cup playoffs. Croatia. They only took control of that first leg, really, after Iceland had a man sent off early in the second half. And even then, for all their possession, they couldn't break down their opponents. How do you account for that? And I don't know. I mean, what's really happened to them? Because their last four games of the qualifiers, they only took 1 point, and here they are, struggled to compete against 10-man Iceland. What do you see going on there?
You know, it's just as well they got off to such a good start, because if that dip in form had come any earlier, they could have well been caught by even the likes of Serbia. Certainly in the outset of that group, I watched that pretty carefully, because Scotland was involved and Croatia and Belgium certainly looked a class, and to some extent Croatia looked like a match for Belgium. But by the end of it, Belgium had kind of tore away and left Croatia quite a bit behind. The thing that impressed me about Iceland was their work rate. Even with 10 men, it did not look like they were playing with 10 men. I thought their commitment, their energy was fantastic. I think maybe one of the concerns would be Tuesday is the fact that they've got to do that and perhaps a little bit more again against the Croatian side that had a lot of the ball and didn't have to work nearly as hard as Iceland did. But I think it was really one of these classic situations. Croatia only played as well as they were allowed to play, because Iceland put so much pressure on the tempo they set right from the beginning, and the energy they put in the game, I thought was absolutely outstanding. And maybe it's a case of they have to play that way to remain competitive, because if they're going to rely purely on skill and technique, then Iceland are going to perhaps come up a little bit short. But Croatia did have chances. The most of them fell to Perisic, which probably isn't necessarily the man they want their chances to fall to. And I thought it was kind of interesting when that sending off happened, because in half they seemed to attack down, they seemed to kind of key on that left side a little bit with Perisic. And then in the second half, even though the right back had got sent off, you would have thought they would have continued with that. But then Olic came on that right-hand side, and then they seemed to kind of concentrate on feeding Olic. And nearly came kind of good for them a couple of times, but I thought it was strange that they would change their point of attack and the emphasis. You've got to still consider Croatia, I think, favourites to go through, but I also, in the back of my mind, is it would be really interesting, it would make a very interesting tie if Iceland could take the lead in this one.
No doubt. I think a lot of people were surprised by Greece scoring 3 goals against Romania.
All because, in one game.
Yeah. Because they're such a defensive side. Do you think they're going to return to that sort of conservative, let's shut them down style, or are they going to do what they did in the first leg?
You know, Greece are such a strange team, because they seem to have sort of perfected this ability to find their way to get through things. They haven't threatened to do anything close to what they did in 2004 since then, and that's completely understandable, in itself still remains one of the great shocks of international football. But they do find a way of getting the results when they need them. I half expected them even to manage to pip out Bosnia at the end of the group stage. Bosnia had that little stumble against, I think it was Slovakia, and then recovered. But it wouldn't have surprised me if Greece had managed to just nick through as group winners, as it is. They went through the runners-up. And suddenly, if we looked at this game, I think most people would have said if Greece are going to win, it's going to be a 1-0 tight event, and they're going to find their way through. But to see them score 3 goals is quite it's something we haven't seen for quite some time against decent opposition. But I think when they go to Romania now, 2-0 takes Romania through, but two goals at this level, to win by two clear goals and a 2-0 result is very, very difficult. So I think it's Croatia or Greece going back to their kind of standard approach. Now, the thing they have got going for them is Mitroglou is in a fine vein of form just now, both right. at club level and international level. I remember seeing him back in, I would say it's got to be 2009, 2010, when he was playing for Olympiacos, and he looked like a sort of big, raw-boned, kind of muscular striker who hadn't quite got it all together. And from what I understand, he went out on loan after that, but it all seems to be coming good for him. He's got the size, he seems to have the touch, and he's certainly got an eye for a goal. So maybe this is a case of one player coming good for Greece just when they need him.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about him because he's obviously scoring bags of goals for Olympiacos. Has he done enough, do you think, for both club and country that, you know, possibly, whether it be in January or next summer, that he might earn, a transfer to one of Europe's big glamour clubs?
I think you've got to say that any time somebody scores a lot of goals, almost in any league around the world, that he's going to attract attention. Whether he can do this, whether he can step up and actually deliver at that kind of elite level of, you know, the big four or big five leagues, I think that's one of these situations sometimes, well, more often than not, we don't find out until somebody gives it a shot. It's interesting that you look at one of his teammates in the Greece national team, like Samaras, who scored lots of goals in Holland before he went to Manchester City. He's kind of failed at Manchester City. He went up to Scotland. He's been a relative success in Scotland, although his inconsistency drives managers crazy for the first 2 years he's there. But you look at Samaras's performances in particularly the Champions League for Celtic, where he really has come into his own. He's turned into he can play as an out-and-out striker, but he can also drift deeper and play in these kind of midfield roles as well. So sometimes it's maybe they find out they're not quite good enough for the elite level on a week-in, week-out basis. But if you ask me, I think there's a good chance Mitroglou is going to be on his way come next summer, and he is going to get a chance. Whether he can actually come through or not, I guess we'll have to find that one out. That's harder to say.
Right. But before we let you go, maybe you can tell our listeners how they can check out some of your fine work.
Well, I guess every week someone's up on Forbes.com under, I think it's, we call it the soccer trade, so there's a weekly column, sometimes twice a week, depending on whether we have something of enough interest to write about. So that's up there. Generally, you can hear me pretty regularly on The Fan, on various talk shows as topics come up relating to soccer, whether it be Champions League, World Cup or the Premier League, and Soccer Central, which I believe will be back on the air sometime next week.
I believe the 25th it's going to be back. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll look forward to that. Good stuff, Bobby. Thanks for joining us, and keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on, John.
Okay. So just a reminder, you can watch three of Tuesday's European World Cup playoff games live on Sportsnet. At 2 p.m. Eastern, it's Croatia versus Iceland on Sportsnet 1. At 2:30 Eastern, you can watch Sweden versus Portugal on all four Sportsnet main channels. And also at 2:30, you can watch Ukraine versus France on Sportsnet 360. And we're also showing a pair of friendlies on Tuesday. You can watch Slovenia versus Canada on Sportsnet 1 at noon Eastern, and England versus Germany on Sportsnet World at 2:30 Eastern. That's another edition of the Soccer Central podcast in the books. You can check back on Thursday for our next show, as James Sharman is going to join me to preview the weekend's Premier League action. We're also going to talk some Bundesliga with Raphael Honigstein of the Guardian newspaper, ahead of the Bayern Munich Borussia Dortmund game on Saturday. Until then, cheers for listening.